You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. We're very excited this evening because we have a returning guest and someone we like very, very much. Charlie, you're with me today.
Hello.
And who have we got with us?
We have got an author and presenter of the Haunted Histories podcast. We've got Penny Griffiths Morgan with us. Thank you so much for joining us, Penny.
Well, thank you, guys. I've been looking forward to doing this.
Oh, us too. It's taken a while to get it together, hasn't it? So we're going to talk about your new book.
Yes.
But before we do that, tell them what, for you, because I think there's some variations, isn't there? So for you, what does paranormal history entail? Because that's your speciality.
It is, yeah. I could do this over 2 minutes. I could do it over 20. But if I take the two separately, paranormal is anything you can't really explain logically. So paranormal means not normal. The history side is the fact that people who are into the paranormal are always looking at ways to validate or debunk. And if you're listening to this, you won't see me do this, but in speech commas, the evidence that they find. From the history side, I like to come in and explain what would have been happening at that point in history if they found something that's got historical relevance. Also using my knowledge of history maybe to do the research for them. So if they come up with a name, say a name that was associated with R.E.F. Tibbenham, for example, like I had in my second book, I will then find see if I can find those flight records, see if I can find who that person was, see if I can find the backstory for them. And then it's all about sort of setting the scene in places and letting them understand quite what would have been going on in that time, so that when you're doing an investigation, when you target it properly, I'll give you an example. If you use the word TB in a Victorian setting, if there is a ghost, they may not understand what you mean by TB. So simplistically, you would say consumption. Do you get what I mean? So even though it can go as simple as that, or it can go as broad as giving people an hour-long talk about, I don't know, the Victorian workhouse, so that then they can come up with things that are applicable to the Victorian workhouse to then use to investigate with. So it kind of covers everything. But one of the main things is it's finding evidence for people. And when you do get a name come up through a device, like a random name, and then you find out the information they've given you ties in to, say a soldier who fought in the trenches or something else, it's quite mind-blowing. And especially as a historian, because it does almost feel like somebody from the past is talking to me to tell me something I need to know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really interesting stuff. Do you think sometimes that a little bit of knowledge of history affects people's interaction with the paranormal? So, for example, people hear a screaming woman at Hampton Court and automatically assume that that's the one that they've heard of.
Funnily enough, we were talking about this before we start recording, weren't we?
Yes. It was seamless how I brought it in.
Really. I was very impressed.
It's same in the reincarnation stuff, isn't it? Nobody's ever the reincarnation of a peasant. Nefertiti.
No, I agree. I mean, that's a whole different...
let's not touch that level of...
reincarnation and old head on young shoulders and all that stuff. Yes, people don't. One of the biggest problems with some people in the paranormal, I won't say all, because I say some, they don't research. They take it at face value what they've discovered. So, for example, the book we're going to be talking about, somebody said that the guy who lived in the master's house told them he had three children. And they went, oh, did he? Oh, so actually, no, he had five. but he could have been talking about there was only three living there at that point, you know. So it's rather than honing up, and they knew that he had children, so they assumed it was the right number. That's a simple one. But like you say, about people automatically assume it's one specific person in history because they've heard her story. That we talked about Catherine Howard, the fact that when she heard that, say, Henry wasn't too happy with her, she ran screaming down the corridor.
I suppose she got away from her jailers, didn't she, after she'd been sentenced to death.
And she ran to his private...
That has the balcony entrance for the King's Chapel. And he was crying and she was banging on the door.
That's right. And so people automatically assume if they hear a screaming woman, it's got to be her. Now, it could be. It could be. But what I would come in and do is say, well, about all the other people, it doesn't have to be the king or the queen or the princess that's doing the haunting. It could be one of the lady in waitings. It could be a serving girl. It could be, and yes, so having a little bit of knowledge, whilst it's good to make you start thinking things through, people do tend to jump. Some people tend to jump to conclusions.
So you are a believer. Mm-hmm. When you're conducting paranormal investigations, what is actually involved, and how do you determine whether something is worthy of your time in terms of doing the historical research, or whether it's just nonsense and you leave it alone?
Ha, that's a really good question. A simple answer. Doing the investigations, there are so many different ways you can do them. You can do them what I would call old school, with a psychic medium, seeing what they pick up, or you can start using some of the sort of modern gadgets that people use, or everything in between. So, you know, for example, a lot of people say they feel a breeze on their face and they think that's a spirit passing by them. Well, the first thing I'm doing is holding a thin piece of paper up and seeing if the paper's flapping, because if the paper's flapping, there is a draft coming in. You know, little things like that. If someone says that they've got there's a temperature fluctuation, you set a thermometer up, like an electronic thermometer, to see if there is a temperature fluctuation. And if there is, one of the things I tend to do then is, there a venting a brick in around the bottom of the building that could be causing that cold spot? So you've got all those kind of things that you want to do. I tend to find that certain places, and I'm not a medium, but I pick up on things, you might feel a bit of a weird, you might suddenly get an image in your head. That's the only way I can explain this. And I did it once when I was at Fort Horsted, down in Kent, isn't it, Fort Horsted? And the psychic medium was picking up on this soldier. And I was seeing a picture of a soldier in my head, and we were almost both describing him at the same time, exactly the same. And he was saying, I can't work out if he's World War One or World War Two. He was one. And I sort of said, well, his uniform, because he had, I don't know what they're called, you know, the things they wear on their legs. In World War One, they were bandages, weren't they? And then in World War Two, they were almost sort of...
Oh, the putties.
Thank you, yes. But the ones I was seeing were bandages. And then I saw this gun in my head, like a big field-type gun. And I said... I think he's showing us World War One. And I did go and look him up, and it was an officer who had been a sort of lower ranking officer in World War One, but because he was quite young, he actually survived and ended up being a higher ranking sort of desk bound officer in World War Two. And I found him, and I found this guy who was linked to Horsted. I don't know for definite that it was him, but the pieces fit. And the photo I found of him, the medium did say, because I get what I tend to do with people, I'm a bit naughty, I'll give them three or four photos and say, who is it you saw? And he picked the right one. So possibly, but it depends how much information there is for me to go on. If it's just, oh, this was a person who lived in the 1800s, not really. But if they get, if you say a first name and a rough date that they feel they were there, of a place, you can then normally use census records and things to see if that person really did exist. So what I do, sometimes I will just look things up for people just to sort of give them an idea, but other times there has to be enough information for me not to be on a wild goose chase. Because as you know, when you're doing historical research, it can be sometimes like a needle in the biggest blooming haystack.
I thought you were going to say a knee in the crotch. I was like, yeah.
Well, that too. that too. And like, when you find the evidence out, people go, nah, you're wrong. And you're like, God, that's the near crotch. But yes, but so it really depends on what the information is that people are coming through with, how ambiguous it is, and, you know, whether they've questioned the what they're getting, if that makes sense. If they're not questioning it, then... But sometimes it's just the information you're getting is just like, nah, this doesn't seem right. I look it up just out of curiosity, and something comes back and absolutely slaps me in the face. It's so accurate. So, yeah, it's really the amount of information. And with me, sometimes it's just a gut feeling that I need to take this further.
Yeah, I guess you can't take it too much for granted, because everything can sound a little bit crazy and off, and...
It sounds completely batty at times, the way I talk, but no, what people don't see is the hours and hours and hours of debunking that I will try and do. You know, nobody wants to, when you write a book, nobody wants to read about all the stuff you do to try and see if it's real or not, or if you can find a plausible explanation. People don't want to know that. It's a bit like with the television shows, like your Ghost Adventures and, dare I say, Most Haunted and stuff. Nobody wants to know that they've spent 9-10 hours for 20 minutes worth of footage. I know that they want to think that's the minute that, you know, the minute you walk into that building, stuff's being thrown at you, and it's not like that.
If only.
Unfortunately.
So a big part of the job is actually trying to disprove your own theories.
Yes. I think you should be. I think if you're an investigator and a researcher, you need to, you know, if you just accept it at face value, how can you argue it when someone says, ah, but. It's like with history research, isn't it? If you come up with I was talking to David O'Keefe recently, the Dieppe, and he was saying the amount of people that go, ah, but, and he says, yeah, well, what about this? What about this? He said, I've gone down every single avenue to see which is plausible. And I think you've got to do that, because then it does create a solid foundation if people do want to try and argue it with you.
That's fantastic. I think, yeah, we can all put that on a t-shirt. That sounds fantastic. So let's talk about your latest book, mm-hmm. Paranormal Playtime, The School That Never Sleeps.
That's the one.
You kicked off writing it with a very specific aim in mind. Can you tell us about what you were hoping would come from writing and researching this book?
Well, everything I do, the aim is pretty much the same. It's to give people tools to ask questions. When I do the history stuff, someone who was specializing in just that would add a lot more detail. But what I want to do is I want the history sort of fans to know that not everyone in the paranormal is like, woo, which we have some logic to us. But I want the people in the paranormal to realize that history isn't, you know, your boring tweed jacket, leather elbows, nah, 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 sort of thing.
We're laughing because actually you're describing Marcus, but he's what's brilliant is that he cultivates that with passion to get there.
Okay, that's probably the bit I didn't explain.
Yeah, not even an insult.
One of my history teachers at school, that's how he looked. He was only probably about 30, but he looked about 60. And he loved his subject, but he would talk like this and mention dates. And I used to fall asleep in his class because there was just no, he obviously enjoyed, but he didn't have any kind of about it. It wasn't, and it wasn't, he didn't dress like that to be ironic, if you know what I mean. He dressed like that because that's how he dressed. And you know, but the best history teacher I ever had was one who would literally be running around the classroom explaining stuff to us and was so excited to be able to talk to us. You couldn't help. I mean, some of the kids thought he was nuts, but I used to think, wow, you feed off that enthusiasm, which is what I want to do when I talk history, whether it's to my son's class when I did a World War II presentation to them last year, whether it's to, I did a presentation on the Air Transport Auxiliary recently to a load of people. I want them to hear the excitement that I'm getting, being able to talk about this. And that's what I'm trying to do, is to get the two sides to meet.
So let's do that. The building we're looking at is currently the British School's Museum in Hitchin. Yes. But naturally, because it would make sense, before it was a museum, it was a school. So tell us a bit about the history of it and what leads people to think it's haunted.
Okay, or this is where I get passionate. Mm-hmm. People, obviously, talking history, If you're listening to this and you already know this, I do apologize if I'm teaching you how to suck eggs. But education cost a lot of money back in the days, sort of before about, well, it was about 1870 that there was a, people started being expected to have an education, but they were still cost money. And so when you've got people who are earning basically nothing, you know, they are not even living hand to mouth in our sort of, but they are literally living hand to mouth. They have only one pair of shoes for five kids, you know, that kind of thing. Their kid not being able to work and them having to spend, say, a shilling a week on education, they haven't got it. So kids didn't learn. And one of around the sort of early 1800s, there was a few movements who were starting to realise that, you know, if we actually teach these kids, if we teach them just a basic, the basic being able to read and write, they're going to be able to get them to start pulling themselves out of that poverty trap. They're going to be able to start doing a slightly better, well-paid job and all of this. And one of those people was a guy called Joseph Lancaster. And he was a Quaker. And he learned to be a teacher and then decided to start teaching kids for free in his parents', in effect, front room. And he pioneered something called the Lancasterian method, which also is known as the monitorial method. So his theory was, well, one of the most expensive, there's two real expenses in teaching, paper and staff. And he said, is there a way we can teach lots and lots of kids without those costs? And so he came up with a monitorial method where you could have like 60 or 70 kids, one teacher, but then for every sort of 10 kids, there would be what they'd call a pupil monitor who'd sort of gone up the grades, if you like, and was able to supervise whatever row they were responsible for. And he also started to work on ways of not having to use paper. So, for example, when kids were first learning how to form a number or a letter, they would use a tray of sand. From the sand, they would go up to slate and chalk. It was only when they were totally competent with the slate side of things, slate and chalk, that they would then get given a pen and paper to start practicing with. So it was a way of reducing the costs, obviously, you know, recycling stuff and everything else. And then with books, there would only ever be two copies of a book. So you would have the copy that the teacher had. And then what they would do is they would have the pages around the room. And if your group was learning from that page, you would be sent over there with your group, your monitor, who would then, you would read from the page on the wall. So it started to save money. Now, this took off. His ideas were really, you know, popular. And it was also a few years later that the national schools movement started under something called the Madras Method with Dr. Andrew Bell, which is very, very similar to Lancaster's. And there is quite a lot of competition between the two as to who's taken with it first. Uh-huh. I'm pro Joseph. I have to say I'm pro Lancaster for obvious reasons because I've written about him. But there is a bit of competition between who came, but they both were doing it for the right reasons. It was to educate, whereas national schools were Church of England schools. So if you see a Church of England C of E school, a lot of those started off as national schools and would have been in the villages and things. Mm. Whereas what Lancaster was doing was non-denominational. And it was quite an important thing because they didn't, but you know, whereas Sunday schools were Robert Raikes 50 years ago, they had expected kids to literally just learn to read the Bible and that was it. They weren't expected to actually what I call learn. It was more just reciting the Bible and then learning catechism and that kind of thing. The other thing with Lancaster is he didn't believe in the kind of corporal punishment that people like Robert Raikes. I mean, Robert Raikes was very much a, you know, what was it, spare the rod, spoil the child type person. Lancaster believed in you didn't need to beat the living daylights out of a child to get them to work. If you actually made them look stupid to their friends, they're more likely to pull their weight because they don't want to look stupid. And he also believed in like the reward system, like reward them for doing something well. It doesn't mean necessarily they're the best student, but if you know you've got a child who's 10 years old and whose parents, if he doesn't or she doesn't go out to work, the parents will only be able to eat meat once a week, yet that child is making the effort to come to school every single day,
yeah,
reward them for that with a token or in some cases, when they got really sort of, the money was a bit more fluid, they were given a book as a present, as a reward. So his whole method of teaching was very, very different to what people, and it was very, very low cost. And in some cases, he didn't charge, which is why he was bankrupt on more than one occasion. He did actually spend time in Fleet on the debtor's prison on more than one occasion because he wasn't very good with money. Great teacher, not a great manager. Back in about, I think it was 1808, a local person in Hitchin, a local businessman called William Wilshire, he actually saw Lancaster talk about the benefits because Lancaster was very good at PR. He was traveling all over the UK promoting this type of education. And he was very impressed. And so he donated a Maltings, an old Maltings that he was responsible for, to the Lancasterian group, the Royal Lancasterian Society, to turn into a school. And so that's when the Hitchin School first, it was actually 1810 that it first opened under the Lancasterian method of teaching, to provide teaching to low-cost teaching, low-cost education to those people who couldn't afford it any other way. So that was how the school started.
Right. So what about it makes us think it's haunted now, this building?
Well, this is when it gets a bit sort of theoretical. One of the theories is that places where children have been creates a lot of energy. And in sort of the paranormal kind of conversations, there is something called stone tape theory. And stone tape theory is that the atmosphere, if you like, absorbs events. I always say it's a bit like having a Groundhog Day with a video, that the same video just loops over and over again. And that's called a residual haunting. And they believe this stone tape theory thing, that the atmosphere absorbs something that had a lot of energy associated with it that then loops over and over again. That is Catherine Howard running down the gallery at Hampton Court. Obviously, the energy she would have been expelling at that point when she's about to be executed.
Right.
It could be the kind of energy that gets absorbed into it. So they, and because children do have that kind of innocent, I say innocent, mine aren't always innocent, but you know what I mean? They do have that kind of pure, unadulterated energy about them. And the fact that for a lot of these children, it was a lot safer for them to be in these schools than at home. When you read about a lot of the children at Hitchin, for example, they've been what we call the yards. And the yards were these, and Hitchin, the school is in the very, what was the very poor part of Hitchin. It was originally on Dead Street, and that's what the road was called, Dead Street. And these yards were like, they were horrendous. You'd have, I think I worked out in one street that had some like 20, 24 houses, there was over 89 people living in them.
Wow.
So, you know, for these children to come into school, they would be a lot safer and less likely to be abused, less likely to be, you know, have to work 15, 16 hours a day. It was a nicer life for them. So it was a happy place for them to go back to, which is another reason why they think it could be haunted. That there's no sort of major deaths been listed, you know, no horrific events or anything like that. There was a death in the master's house. The actual master who lived there, he died there, he retired, and he died in the actual house. But that I have found some of the children who went there did die quite young once they'd left school at 13. So it could be they're going back there because it was their happy place. They liked it there. They had attention. They were treated like children.
And that much energy, as you say, gets trapped and gets stuck. Is this the same sort of thing that gets reported along ley lines?
Similar. Ley lines are meant to be almost like a magnetic attractor to things. It's similar to places that got a high contents of quartz in the earth is meant to have a lot of paranormal activity. And as I say, they're all theories as to why these things happen. I mean, I think it's, I'm sure it's Glastonbury that's meant to be on the point of crossing of two of the most powerful ley lines that there is. But you don't actually hear that many hauntings at Glastonbury, just that it's a very pagan spiritual place. But yeah, ley lines are meant to be almost like a sort of a magnetic attractor for things, same as like, say, anything limestone that has a high content of quartz in. Another one that's meant to be, and this could probably apply to Hitchin, because as it is a very, very old town, it dates back to Saxon, if not before. and they would build on a river. Hitchin has a river running through it, the Hitch. It's spelled H-I-C, I believe, pronounced Hitch. And there are theories that water is a conductor of spiritual activity as well, and but also manages to trap whatever's it's around. So you know, nobody really knows, but Hitchin has got a lot of paranormal stuff associated with it, which doesn't really surprise me because the age of the place and the amount of different eras in sort of history it's seen. But yeah, the school, my theory on why the school is the way it is, it's because of the children in there and the energy that those children, if anyone heard screaming then, it was my son having a tantrum downstairs. It's quite good as I'm saying about children's energy.
Perfect.
Yeah. Downstairs, it's like, well done, son. It's kind of, yeah, it's the, just the sheer innocent energy that they would have brought to the place has kind of almost acts like a battery pack to it. Because some places I've visited, you know, you feel quite, it feels quite oppressive inside. It feels like it really doesn't want you there. The school, it feels like coming home whenever I go there. I it's one of the buildings I would quite happily be left there on my own at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't feel it's intimidating at all. It's quite pleased to have you there. If that sounds completely mad. But no, it
doesn't at all. So it's a good energy. It's a good vibe.
I think so.
So how does it, how do this, does this energy manifest itself at this school then?
There's, I mean, I experience this, there's lots of reports of hearing children laughing, giggling. The, where I mentioned about them writing in the sand, they actually have it, there is actually what's called the Lancasterian classroom. It's called, or the hall as it's known. And for anyone listening who is a teacher, this could hold up to 300 children with just one school teacher. Oh. Yeah, when I told one of my son's teachers that, he went very, very pale and went pass. But so, and there's been cases where, you know, we've been sitting there in the room, nobody else is in. It's a huge hall. Mm-hmm. I've got pictures of it on my website and everything else. And we'll be sitting at one end and we've cleared the sand tray at the front and gone back and seen a letter's been written in it and there's been nobody in there. So things like that, like quite mischievous things. We've had desks slam open and shut before. My favorite one in one of the what's called the gallery classroom, like the more sort of Victorian type one you think of on steps.
Yeah,
I was there doing an investigation and we did hear footsteps outside and went running out, nobody there, and it was distinct footsteps. But I was kind of, because you try not to make a noise because everyone, you know, minute someone hears a creak they're like and you try not to make a noise. And I remember I was leaning on the desk and these desks are bolted down, leaning on the desk, and the desk literally jumped underneath me. It was like it suddenly had an electric shock go through it. It was so weird. And I sort of went, ah, and slipped. But this desk moved. I tried debunking. I tried replicating it. Nobody else was moving. I tried getting somebody to run up and down next to my desk, jump in front of it. I even looked to see, I went up with a cable detector, see if there's any electric cables running underneath it or any pipes that could have expanded. Nothing. This desk jumped underneath my arms. So I think a lot of the activity that the kids do is quite mischievous.
Yeah.
Like kids would be, because, you know, and sometimes you do have to kind of say to them, you're not going to get in trouble if you do something. You are allowed to be a bit cheeky. And you do have to, it's almost like once you keep saying to them, you can be a bit cheeky. You can. We had one case there where there was the girl, we did what's called a trigger. And so with a trigger, you kind of are trying to replicate something that would make them, they would understand. So we got a girl to sit in the corner with a dunce's hat on. Now, I'm not a fan of the dunce's hat. I think it was a horrible thing. But, you know, back then it was one of the tamer punishments, I suppose. And we said to the spirits, come on, if you're here, push that hat off. And they did. We saw it. If you can imagine, it's like a paper dunce's hat. We saw the girl wasn't moving. We got it on camera. We saw the hat like dent slightly and start moving, whereas if someone was pushing it with their hands. So most of the stuff you get there, if it's what we call interactive, it's very naughty, it's cheeky, it's kids being kids.
Gosh. So you say that you filmed that, you caught it on camera. There's a part of me that's listening to your stories, and I've come out here, I'm an absolute believer, but I've never seen anything. I've never experienced anything other than
you need to come out with me, girl.
Exactly. So when you go out on these kind of these investigations, what are you hoping to achieve? How is it kind of, I think I'm asking, how do you quantify the experience?
I never expect anything. You know, to me, the opportunity to get to these beautiful old buildings with, I don't have the children with me telling me they're bored. I don't have other people sort of getting in the way when you're trying to just sit there. And, you know, when you just sit in a room and just listen to the room, do you know what I'm talking about? When you just sit somewhere and you just absorb.
What are your kids, 10 and 12? That don't happen.
Well, one you heard screaming, he's 8 on Friday. Okay, so happy birthday to him this Friday. The other one's 12, who you've met, Alex, online. He's 12 next month. So no, you don't get peace and quiet. But, you know, but even if you go as adults and you've got other people in a museum or an old building looking around, you get people who don't want to be there. But when you get a group of people who are investigating, everyone wants to be there. Everyone. And so I can tell you to a sort of a group, if they've hired somewhere, look, I'm just going to wander off to that room over there, shut the door and just sit for hours. And nobody thinks you're weird, which is always a good thing. Nobody will interrupt. And you can just absorb and think and learn about the place, which is what, that's my objective when I go somewhere, is to learn something, whether that be paranormal, whether it be historical, or whether it just be what I'm capable of. When something does happen, the first thing I will do, well, I do tend to write everything down, because otherwise you forget all the little bits. Sometimes when I go back through my investigation notes, I'm like, I didn't remember that happening at that point. Wow. So yes, I document everything. Using voice recorders a lot when you do what's called a electronic voice phenomenon session, EVP session, when you're asking questions and hoping to get a reply, all that kind of thing. I don't always film everything, because sometimes the people you go with don't want to be filmed.
Yeah.
But there's normally, I'm normally writing stuff down as it's happening, so I don't forget, because then I'm going to try and debunk it. So with the desk jumping up, at the time I tried to debunk it, couldn't. I went back a few days later in daylight with the museum curator, and we went through the blueprint. We went through everything that could have gone on in that room to try and debunk it, and couldn't. So, but that one experience, and that wasn't the best one I had at that place that night, that one experience would make your whole night. You don't need to have stuff happening every five. That is enough to make you go, that has blown my mind. I don't know why that happened. So to answer your question, I don't go in with any expectations. If anything happens, it's a bonus. But it's rare that something doesn't happen if you just sit and listen. If you don't, you don't need to make it happen. I sound really cuckoo now, but there's normally someone who wants to tell you something if you're just a patient and you're that kind of person. I find you, if you're the kind of person that complete strangers come and talk to you at the bus stop, you do good on this.
See, Charlie would be great with you, I think. My millennial attention span would be just buggered after 10 minutes. I think I would put them off. You've talked about, when we were preparing this episode, Hitchin and how old it is. You've mentioned that already. Are they linked, any of these stories? Because you said that there's other buildings, aren't there, and other sites in Hitchin. Is any of this linked together, or is it just a general aura of sort of out there activity?
Well, until I started researching, originally the book was going to be just on the school. But They had wanted me to get it written and published for this year, because it's the school's 25th anniversary of being a museum. And it takes me about a year to write one of these, with investigations, with research, getting into records offices. It's not just a case of I do my research. Obviously, last year, March, I just started writing this. Had about 5 investigations planned to do at the school, I was due to be going to Brno University, where the British and Foreign School Society archives are kept, all that stuff, COVID. So that's why I thought, well, I need to find stuff, because they need the book done for this year. Don't know how long COVID is going to last. So I started having to think laterally. And that's why I did put a few bits in about other parts of the town that people, and that's when I started thinking, blimey, this place, for a small place, it's got a hell of a lot going on. I did look into the ground composition to see if it was the quartz thing I mentioned earlier, and I couldn't find any confirmation of that. I think it is just down to, well, it's just down to the difference in people that have lived there and the things that have happened. It has been, Hertfordshire in general, St Albans especially, has had quite a lot of religious connotations, which can sometimes give rise to ghost stories because of everyone wants to see the monk, the black monk or whatever. I also know that, you know, you did have quite a lot of battles. The English Civil War took place nearby, came through. You had highwaymen come through. So there would have been a lot of quite antagonistic energies going on. I don't know why it's got the activity levels it has, if I'm honest. And I've spoken to other people who've investigated different parts of Hitchin. They don't know why either. It just seems to be the case, but it could just be down to the fact that it has been around for sort of thousands of years. So there's a lot of things that have just built up in general. I am hoping to get to investigate the Priory and the Sun Hotel, which I mentioned in there at some point, but, you know, places are only just starting to be reopened to investigations now, and they're still a bit sort of scared of allowing groups of people in. But yeah, I'll be honest, if I don't know, I don't know why it's the way it is. I think it could just be down to the age and the fact that so many different things have happened there, and possibly the river could be to do with it as well.
That's so interesting. I'm in Bedford, so I'm only up the road, so we'll definitely come and hunt some stuff around Hitchin with you. So you touched on it was very tantalizing, and it came and it went as quickly as it came from your mouth. You said that the desk at the school that jumped under you was not the most exciting thing that happened to you at the school. Can you tell us, or do we have to buy the book? Because I really want to know.
I'm not going to tell you anything else apart from this story. If you want to learn anything else that I experienced at the school, you've got to buy
the book. All right, one more.
That's fair, isn't it? Right. So the group I was investigating with, we'd gone out for a meal just up the road beforehand. Like, when you're going to be on your feet for 7-8 hours, you need to have some food beforehand. Mm-hmm. And they'd gone off in their cars. I didn't really know where I was going, so I was following my sat-nav. Didn't realise I could park at the school, so I'd parked in a pay and display just up the road that was free, but it was a public car park. And so I'm walking up to the school to try and find everyone. Couldn't hear any sort of voices or anyone talking. There was no one in the car. So I'm like, oh God, I'm just gonna have to try doors, aren't I, to see. And if you look at a picture of the front, if you're looking at the front of it, you've got like the school building on your left and then these two houses on your right. Okay. And then there's gates, and the gates lead into the school playground. Well, I'm thinking, well, those houses look like offices, and it said school, like British Schools Museum or something on the door. And I thought, those houses look like offices. Maybe they're in there. Maybe there's like a function room in there that they're all sitting in or something. And as I looked at this window, I saw a woman, and I can't think how to describe her hair other than it was in that sort of Edwardian pompadour style that the women wear. And I could see her through the window, and she's bending over a desk. And so I thought, okay, it's just someone who likes to wear their hair a bit different. They must be in there. And so I tried the big front door, and it opened. And I walked in, I tried the door to my right. That was unlocked. Tried the door to my left, where I'd seen this woman. It was open and unlocked. And I opened it and walked straight in. There's no one there. I suddenly realised I'm in a private office. So sort of being a bit bonkers, I was like, I'm sorry, thinking if anyone was in there, they'd hear me apologise, and made my way out. And then went into the main school building to look. And chatting to the museum manager afterwards, I said, oh, mate, you need to know that door that's right by the road is unlocked into your offices, and your offices are open. And he went, no, they're not. And I went, they are. I've just been in there. They're open. And he said, they're not. I locked them before I came out. And he said, and the office you're talking about you went into is one of those keypad ones. It locks automatically when the door was shut. Was the door shut? And I went, yeah, I just turned the handle and opened it. And he goes, we never used that front door. That front door's always locked. I went, well, it opened. And I said about seeing the woman in the window. And he goes, I'm the only person on duty tonight. There's nobody else in there. It's all locked. And so we went over there, and this was probably about 15, 20 minutes after it happened. And no, none of the public had arrived by this point to do the public side of it. It was just us. And yeah, big front door, locked, can't get into it, locked completely. Now, it hadn't dropped a latch when I pulled it. I just pulled it too. He unlocked it for me and we went in. And yet the office I'd gone into, locked. And he said, this is what, and he did the keypad thing. He said, it's an automatic thing. And he showed me two or three times it was an automatic one. It locked when you shut the door. It was only afterwards that I found out that that house had actually been the schoolmistress's house. And I'd seen a woman with her hair up in like a bun, sort of Edwardian style bun, in the window, leaning over.
Wow.
Now, I didn't get photos of it. People can believe me if they want to, but it kind of, those doors unlocked for me so I could go in.
The debunking of that must have been really fun. You know, has he... Did the man who works in the office have a fancy woman who liked to dress up in Edwardian style, hiding in the cupboard?
Didn't actually ask him that, but he was as kind of as stunned as I was.
Yeah,
because this door to this is right next to the road, so you wouldn't want to leave it unlocked because it's the offices, it's where they would keep all the sort of important stuff. And he knowing him, he was quite fastidious about locking things up. And it was locked when I went back there 15, 20 minutes later, and nobody else had appeared. Nobody else had been at that point. He was the only staff member on who would have had keys. That was my most, that still for the school is my moment. That it kind of almost was like that as soon as I walked on the premise, they wanted me to write about them. That's the only way I can think of. But I did say when I went back and the door was locked, and I couldn't get in. And then when I found out it's where the schoolmistress had lived, that kind of thing tallies. Yeah, they have said I can go back and do more investigations, but actually in that part of the building if I want to, because it's not open to the general public, obviously. But yeah, going forwards, they have said I can sort of literally spend the day in there, night in there, and see what happens. See if my schoolmistress wants to talk to me again.
That's insane.
But where the history side comes in. It's the finding out that the two houses, one was the mistress's, one was the master's, and this was the mistress's house.
Must be deeply gratifying to know you are not insane.
Well, I'm not sure about that, to be quite honest. I think a little bit. But yes, it gets me, even having done this for years, every time something like that happens, and I had it happen again recently on an investigation about something completely different, it gets me here. I get this kind of sick kind of, I can't explain this. And, but yeah, it made me think when they then said to me, would you like to write about this place? That experience made me think I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
Sounding too bonkers. That made me think I'm supposed to be writing about here.
And you did. And tell everybody what the book is called. We'll make sure that it's available through the History Hack Bookshop.
Thank you. Paranormal Playtime, The School That Never Sleeps. Oh, and can I just say, on the cover, you see the two boys who are on the cover?
Uh-huh.
That's me too. They're cover stars, which when I first told the older one I was going to use him, he's like, no, you're not. Now he goes around showing it to his friends, goes, look, that's me. My mum wrote this, that's me. The current book I'm writing is a bit different. It's on a place called Bosworth Hall in Market Bosworth. Got a really interesting history to it, got links to Samuel Johnston, people like that, and so I'm talking about that. And again, COVID has caused a few issues with the investigation side because I'm on a time limit for that one as well, so I've also talking a bit about the Battle of Bosworth Field.
Oh, fantastic.
Because the book is actually going to be called The Battle for Bosworth, because one of the people who owned Bosworth Hall was a bit of a pugilist and liked to and a bit of a bully. He actually tried to get his wife's sort of lady-in-waiting arrested and put in jail, supposedly for stealing her clothes, because he found out she didn't like the fact that she had married him and thought she could have done better. So There's an awful lot there. And it was also where a lady, an amazing lady by the name of Florence Dixie lived, whose brother was the one that got Oscar Wilde taken to court for being a sodomite. Tasters for you on that one.
In connotations in that one. Penny, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about the new book. It sounds fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.